welcome to the Chelsea Skidmore Show. I'm here today with two guests, Joanne Barron and D.W. Brown of the Barron Brown Studio, which is an acting school in Santa Monica. They are both actors, writers, directors, and acting coaches as well. How is that intro?
Dandy.
It's always awkward giving the intro right in front of, especially when there's so many hyphenates.
Yes. And don't box me up.
I know.
I thought it was a very good introduction. She's a very gifted introducer and actress because she took very good training, and so she's really talented.
Yes, I just finished the two-year program at your school, Barron Brown, which I absolutely loved. Jamie Kennedy had discussed it briefly with me on his episode. DW was my teacher, and Joanne and DW are married and have a studio together. How fun is that?
We met on a movie called Joy of Sex.
Really?
Which had very little sex in it. It was not very joyful.
Is that true?
Yes.
That's strange.
It was Martha Coolidge's movie. I did Valley Girl. Then she said, you could be the next movie I have. Just do this part. And then she said, the man that you're going to play opposite is going to be very attractive. And I said, really attractive? And she said, well, I don't want to spoil it for you. And then I was standing in a trailer, and this breathtakingly handsome man walked by, and I said, I'm going to marry him. And then Colleen Camp, who went to the school eventually, she was an actress in it, and she said, you're not going to marry him. He's too handsome. He's going to go out with a model.
Ew.
And I said, no,
this story never gets old.
No, I think it was true. And I said, no, I really believe he will marry me. And that was it.
Wow. Yeah, I hear a lot of girls say similar, people say similar. I always love to hear stories like that. I love, like, when people first see someone and they're like, that's the person. It's so cute. Yeah, he's given me some marriage advice a little bit because I recently just got married.
Oh, wow. Oh, good. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been 2 years? A year and a half? I'm looking to Mike for the answer.
What was his marriage advice? I'll tell you if it's true.
It's ever evolving.
I can't even remember.
I was just generally in class. I would tell you that stuff of probably be a receiver or a sender. You'd be clear that one guy's the receiver and one guy's the sender.
Is that like feminine, masculine energy sort of thing?
No, this is when you're having a conflict. You go, I need to be the sender, so I don't need you coming back at me with your defense. I need to get the feeling that you – it's like we in the class – we do this thing called repetition to begin with, so you're making sure that you're getting the other person, that I'm repeating the thing you say. So this is actually kind of marriage therapy, is that you want them to get that you get what they're saying.
Yeah, that's almost like that listening chart.
So you can't remember what he said.
I can't.
So you can't use it.
I know he told me something. Maybe something about, like, keeping the romance. Could it have been?
I said, my general advice is for men, the way to keep a relationship is to keep the romance, and for women is to keep him feeling competent.
Oh, that was it. Yes. Competent?
Competent, yeah.
Not okay.
That's really his
personal. Meaning what?
Meaning the kind of like cheerleader, kind of a...
Okay, like encouraging him.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I started doing that after you told me that. More than usual. And then what is it like, because you're not at the studio as much anymore, but you were, I guess we can get into a history of the studio in a second, but what has it been like working together as a couple? And like, how do you guys balance the work life when you come home? Like, do you guys have to shut off the industry talk?
No.
I always ask this to couples who, does it get exhausting? Or you're like, enough?
No, we are doing two very different things. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm the artistic director, so I'm running the physical studio, dealing with the running of the business, so to speak, overseeing the other teachers. He's the head teacher, and he's actually going in and teaching. And I haven't really taught so much for probably about 25 years. And I only do like one time, maybe twice, maybe three times, 4 days, 12 days total a year of a master class. So I'm like more auditioning and trying to, pursue opportunities by producing or writing or auditioning or acting. And he's more screenwriting and directing and tying that into being an on-site teacher directing actors like you, talented people like you. And
But in answer to her question, we do talk. We don't. We don't.
But I don't tell you what to do.
No, no, no.
Because that's like.
But we do. You know, in a confession that's fallen out of favor, people don't know what I'm talking about. Where I say our holidays are busman's holidays. You ever heard that expression?
No.
Yeah. So we're whenever we go on vacation, we go to see plays.
Well, I noticed. Yeah, I've seen that on your social media.
Yeah. So we talk about it, all this stuff. And we talk about.
But we don't. At school, have conflicts like people who have jobs together that they sometimes say like, oh, I don't want to work with my husband because I learned that it was important in a marriage that he be able to have complete autonomy as co-owner of the school and run his class. So I don't walk on that. I allow, you know, that separation. So he has his independence and autonomy, and he does actually have a different kind of approach. And then all the other teachers and I were sort of in a artistic directorship with me sort of, you know, going through work with them or training teachers. So he's a brilliant teacher. He's a director. He's a writer. I don't, you know, oversee him. Mm-hmm. And he's my husband. And I don't think that works out. I don't think it works out to tell – maybe it would for somebody, but not in our case, for me to tell him what to do.
Yeah, because you guys do such separate stuff, essentially. There's no crossover, really.
Well, it's the same thing, but I'm not bossing him around.
Okay, good.
I don't say to him, you know, hey, what are you doing in your class? Do it this way. But another teacher, I could say, hey, you know what? I think this would work good.
Mm.
I'll give you an example. All the people in our school turn in scene lists every time people are doing scenes. He doesn't give me a scene list.
Nice.
He makes his own scenes. So that's the difference. When they give me a scene list, I go over it with them. I coach them. I mentor them. I only would do that if he asked me. If he said, hey, what's a good scene for this girl? You worked with her in the master class.
Mm, mm-hmm. So I want to get a little bit of a brief backstory for each of you before you met with your own acting experience and maybe just, you know, feel free to get into some childhood trauma, whatever. Whoever wants. And just kind of like, and then like what brought you to, you know, wanting to open your own studio and maybe like some early acting history, whoever. Just make it your own thing.
I'll just start because I met him after. I was an actress and I was, you know, singing with Sissy Houston, Whitney Houston's mom. And I was doing like singing with a few funny comments and touring. And I was on Broadway, and I was in shows like Eyes of Laura Mars with Faye Dunaway. After I had studied with this guy, Bill Esper Studio in New York, the offshoot of the Neighborhood Playhouse. And he would come and see me, my acting teacher,
wow,
which is really unusual. And he was very much excited that I was going to become a star. And I even was on like a show that he saw before he ever met me called The Making of a Star with this guy, Tom Snyder, who you're way too young to know was ever a talk show host. But... long story short, I didn't like it when I didn't work. I became, like, miserable. So I went to Bill Esper and said, I really need to do something with my life besides be an actress. And he was like, don't do it. You're going to be a star and make me famous. And I said, Bill, I really, really can't, you know, take not having a place to be, not having any money. Sometimes I work, sometimes I don't. And he said, no. I don't want you to be a teacher. You are going to be a star. So I talked him into letting me watch class. So for 1 year, I watched class, and then he gave me two people, David Longinani, a lawyer, and Suzanne von Schaak, who's still acting, a hand model, maybe a foot model. I don't know. She was 7 feet tall. And he
told
me, huge. Look at her on Instagram. She's an Amazonian. And he said, you can teach them for a whole year, and I'll look at you do their final scene at the end. And he came and he saw their final scene after a year, and he said, you know what? I think you have a lot of talent for teaching. And I'm disappointed that, you know, it's worked out this way and let me teach. And the first year that I taught, I was immediately successful. Like, acting is so hard, and comedy, which I have so much respect for, is so grueling and so much mastery and so many years of putting in so much. But for some reason, God, the universe, I taught. And the one time I taught, everybody ended up in that first class. Not everybody, but a lot of people with an Emmy.
Wow.
And they've never acted before. So I then became like a famous teacher overnight. And then when I came out here to do a pilot, Lovers and Other Strangers, as an actress, and then The Joy of Sex, which was this not sexy teenage musical movie, he was opposite me. And then we became a couple. And then he wanted to be in the acting class because, you know, Meg Lieberman from CBS, the casting director, put together a whole group of people, including herself. And he was like, hey, I want to take that class. And I was like, people are going to think we're dating, and that's how I met you, and I don't want them to think that I hit on, like, a guy in the class. He's like, no, you got to let me be in class. So he took class. And after he took class...
How was he?
He was very difficult to teach. He wouldn't listen really? To anything I said.
That's so funny.
He wouldn't listen to anything I said. He would be like, what do you mean? Like if I said something. He was very difficult.
You know what's interesting is when people, this is like a little bit of a sidestep, but people, you know, I watch people in class get upset and not, and it's really hard. And I even had a moment too where I was like, I need to like really take in these notes. And like, you know, and I had that awareness, but then I would always watch other people get notes and it would be so awkward sometimes. And it's like, and you can see it because you know, you guys know the best how to read people. And I can't even say how much I learned from just taking that class on like how people really feel about stuff. It's like, no, that's not how you feel. Like it's all over your face and I can read it. Yeah. I feel like almost like a master in that suddenly after just 2 years, but yeah, it's, I also do want to hear about on giving and taking notes, like how to be open for that maybe, or
I'll just say very quickly
to speak on that too.
He wanted to train to be a teacher and that's how he became a teacher.
Okay.
I just wanted to segue into how he became a teacher.
Yeah.
Because everybody trains 5 to 7 years to be a teacher. Okay. Darren Brown. So he then said, I'd like to train to teach.
Great.
But I was already directing.
Well, yeah.
I was in a theater group, so that I came to LA for Fame and Fortune and then got in a theater group and started gravitating towards writing and directing. And so when I took the classes as an actor and director, as many people do, a lot of our people just come for directing.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Reimer says it's the best thing. And he said, I went to USC and I learned more at Baron Brown than USC Film School.
Wow.
Because as you say, it's really more important to be able to read human beings than just the lenses. And
well, Sidney Pollack was a teacher at the Neighborhood Playhouse, this work, and he's one of the great directors. So it makes sense. And David Mamet came out of the training, and Larry David, and all these people. So the writing and the directing kind of it kind of falls into that. And you're a writer.
Mm-hmm. But I really do want to, direct. I mean, when I was sitting in class, I was mostly just watching people and deciding who I would want to cast in things.
Oh, that's cool.
That was like my experience watching in class.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like so many people who like I just keep thinking of for things.
Yeah.
That's
wonderful.
Yeah.
So it's cool to like just, you know.
And that's, you know, that's really, we have in our school, Tom Shadyac. He's a comedy, you know that guy? He's a
Tom
comedy
Shadyac?
Director.
I don't.
He's a comedy director. He met Jim Carrey in an acting class and he directed.
Ace Ventura, Liar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's a big comedy director.
Yeah.
He took the training.
Uh-huh.
And he said he met Jim Carrey in an acting class.
Huh.
So that really feels to me like, you know, a place where people really do start to look at people and appreciate and build bonds, and then later cast them. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing to see somebody's talent in that situation.
And it's cool. Like, some people really just stand out more than others. What do you think are those common characteristics in people who really stand out?
Well, you're talking about...
I know that's kind of a broad question. What makes
a good actor?
Yeah, let's go for that.
Vulnerability.
Yeah. Damn, that's the thing that's, like, the hardest for me.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I, like, need to work on. Do you have any advice for me? Both of you?
Well, I think, you know, it's a lot more difficult to be vulnerable in life than it is to be vulnerable as an actor. Mm-hmm. That you can, like, ritualistically, you know, enter into the fiction and go, okay, in this world, I'm not really Chelsea. I'm this actress, naked animal person. Where in life, it's going to be a lot harder.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing to be, you know, that helps somebody with vulnerability is to remind yourself, I don't have to be like this in life. Life can really hurt you. And people can really hurt you. But in this place, it's safe for me to have that openness because it's for an Academy Award and it's for me allowing my talent to come out. So it's like a mindset. Like sometimes with really masculine, maybe, you know, machismo type dudes, a guy would be like, I don't want to feel that vulnerable and mushy. You know, that's not masculine. And I'd be like, no, you have to be strong to be fragile. You have to be strong to be able to cry. Mm-hmm. You know, when people can't cry, they equalize things with a gun or a loud, you know, music box, or they're going to walk in and take the power with, you know, Obama said brilliantly in a piece that DW played for me that just blew my mind. You know, he said, a real guy doesn't have to wear a whole bunch of change and say he's having sex with millions of women. That's not really saying how strong you are. So being strong is to be able to be vulnerable, mm-hmm. and being vulnerable and acting is safe. And that's what I would encourage someone to feel,
and,
safe.
And, you know, I make the point, vulnerability is not synonymous with frailty. Mm-hmm. It just means that you're affectable.
Yeah.
So you're not armored up. And so, like, a predator is not worried that the gazelle is going to bite it, but it's still vulnerable. I want it so bad. Oh, please let me have that thing. So that, even that kind of vulnerability, to want something and really allow it to hit you.
And then I tell people, you know what? You want to cry and everyone in class is crying and you think they're so talented and you're not crying. Fake it. Make noises. Throw yourself down on the floor. Make a sad face. And maybe if you do that enough, you'll start to really cry.
Oh, wow.
So
yeah.
I tell people, you know, oh, you're so worried you can't cry. And then the other side of it is, don't worry if you can't cry. Because guess what? William Hurt doesn't cry.
Mm.
Robert Duvall didn't cry in Stone Boy. He's from the Meisner. And the idea is, you know, I can believe what my situation is without crying and be very affecting.
Yeah.
You know, if I believe my situation and I'm living my situation, crying or not can be affecting. So there's a lot of things you can tell people.
Yeah, I put a lot on the crying because I would watch everyone in class and, like, so many people just, like, so easily could cry. And I'd be like, how can you do that? And it was such a big thing. I was like, I have to do it. I have to do it. It was like a goal.
I
spent the entire day telling, like, making up a thing that my husband was dead. And I literally spent 10 hours on it. I was like, and then I finally did it in class and I couldn't even face the class. And I remember hearing him say, turn around and face everyone. And I was like, because my back was to everyone, because I didn't want to cry in front of people, because that's like a, you know,
totally.
In child, you know, I don't want to cry. Yeah. I don't want to look weak.
It's synonymous with weakness, yeah.
Yes, yeah. I know it's, but I hear what you guys are saying, but still, like, how do you, like, flip that switch and really just get over it?
Well, you get a certain amount of approval mm-hmm. for having your feelings publicly in an imaginary situation. People are like, oh, that was so good.
Mm.
You were wonderful. And it starts to flip your definition of what is acceptable, attractive, and excellent. And you start to kind of be like third eye in the back of your head, hey, when I'm really fragile, I'm really attractive.
Yeah.
I'm not weak and mushy and impotent. I'm powerful and strong enough to cry. You know, people can't feel their feelings, so they act them out violently, verbally. It takes a strong person to feel what they're feeling and not do something bad with it. So you get
it. Rebrand it.
Rebrand it.
Yeah.
Rebrand it. And if you can rebrand it, your whole thing can turn. And if it turns, you start to get relaxed with it and accepting with it. And, you know, like when I was on Joy of Sex, the movie that I met DW on, I remember I was supposed to cry in a scene and I was like, freaking out because I wasn't crying. And I was like, but I always cried in class and I can't cry now. So this whole thing of pressuring yourself, it's very, you know, it's like, oh, I have to have an orgasm. Oh, I have to get to a result. Oh, I have to be successful. Oh, I have to be famous. Oh, this date has to go well. Anything you do that you put that sword over your head. So you have to really take the result out and say, whatever happens.
Mm.
So there's a lot of little things you can work on.
I love that. Those are all really good. Yeah. I like that. What about, like, unplugging that sort of, like, from your brain into your emotions? Am I saying that right?
Mm, the more primitive self, uh-huh.
Yeah. What about, like, that was, like, something else. I'm selfishly using this for myself right now. That was, like, another thing that I struggled with, like, not being in my head and, like,
yeah, so
you know what the issue was.
Yeah. Like everybody has that, because you're judged in life for mm-hmm. how intelligent you are and how you manage conversation, and that's really not what it's about. It's about emotional intelligence, IQ, EQ.
For the listeners who don't really know exactly what emotional intelligence is, how would you describe that?
Well, you said it pretty easily. I can read what's coming off another person. We have cells in our head that are devoted to it, where it's like a very essential thing that a Homo sapien can read whether another Homo sapien that's approaching them is angry or happy. So we have – it's in our biology to pick up on it, but our society so emphasizes the way you present yourself intellectually and linguistically that you devalue that. So it's just a recovery process. Why children can be like phenomenal actors and emotional savants. They can like read what's really going on in an emotional environment. And it's a good survival skill, you know, to recover. Because you can – people say, oh, I'm fine. Everything's okay. And just like you say, no, it's not okay. This person could be dangerous or this person could be really upset with me. And if I can remedy that now, I won't get fired or I'll heal my romantic relationship or whatever because I'm feeling and trusting my gut. And so that's what the practice is the, if you remember, the mantra is what are they doing? How do I feel about it? Not what are they doing? What do I make of it? How do I come back with some sort of witty retort or you know, make my – intellectual point. That's another piece of marital advice where it says you may win the fight and lose the war. Yeah, so you've won this fight and now you've alienated your partner and they don't want to have anything to do with you. But you won that intellectual battle, didn't you?
Yeah, right.
So it's how do I feel? And so what I'll tell you guys when you come to class, you just walk around asking yourself how you feel about things and not expecting an answer. I like that because if you can box it up, then that really isn't. Yeah, we think and name in one world, we live and feel in another. So where you really live is where you're feeling and just go, how do I feel about the way these people are talking? How do I feel about the way they designed this room? And you just make that a practice and then you're just, again, like putting blood into that part of your brain and reemphasizing.
And when people are really very mature and very put together and very adult, sometimes they came from background, the father's an alcoholic and they had to be the nurse, okay.
Not the nurse, but just like, hello?
And that control was required of you to be holding yourself together. Mm-hmm. So underneath that is this very beautiful, messy, fragile, emotional person that when you let that control down, so, you know, I might say to somebody, you know, sometimes it happens with men, but it could happen with a woman. You know, you're so put together, you're so controlled, you're so stiff. Get on the ground and crawl around and make baby sounds. Now, that might sound like, you know, oh, my God, this acting class is like be a tree. Not really. It's the improvisational work and it's the interpretive work of Sanford Meisner. That's not part of the work. But animal exercises and behavioral exercises that are nonverbal that make somebody reduced to a feeling, like repetition could be ba-ba, ba-ba, boo-boo, boo-boo, and you're repeating the way children do, and now you can't be intellectual. Mm. So there's a lot of ways to bring someone back to their babiness, their virginal birth. You know, one I'm Christian, and one of the reasons I like Christianity is they said you could start again. And I felt like, well, I can forgive myself. I can forgive other people. I can have a new beginning. I feel bad about so many things. Well, that's why I fell in love with Meisner, because Meisner was my first falling in love with rebirth. You go into that training, and I don't care if you want to be an actor, director, writer, casting director, editor, costumer, you're brought to yourself in a way that therapy could take 30 years. And it does bring you back to that beautiful purity of innocence, because you can't have an attitude. You can't rise above the other person. Mm-hmm. You can't block out your experience of reacting. So there's something exquisite about finding a place to be free where you won't be judged or fired or broken up with. So I really think that first year of Meisner is like the most joyful thing. And just the rediscovery, rebirth, it's like divine to me. Mm-hmm. And I think anybody, no matter how controlled, no matter how tough, no matter how shut down, I think most people, unless it's totally chemical, and even if it's chemical, many brilliantly talented people are on antidepressants and all kinds of medication. You can still find a key to open the window and door to your fragile, vulnerable, you know, virginal baby self. You can still get back to that boo-boo place where it's not your mind and it's not your fear and it's not your control. It's just your innocent, free expression.
Where you're like honestly reacting.
Yep.
Sort of.
Yep. And you get so much kudos for being true that's fun. It begins to be fun instead of embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, the whole thing of like when people, you know, a lot of people growing up are like really free and, you know, march to the beat of their own drum, don't really care what people say. And then I think when people hit puberty, probably they start getting, you know, really self-conscious, caring about what other people think. And I hear what you guys say about like, you know, getting back to that like baby childhood, like reactiveness, but also like that other like child energy of not really caring, that's sort of a similar, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. You don't
do
care.
I mean, I always like constantly, I'm like, damn, like I was so much cooler when I was like in middle school and like truly did not care. I was so free and like, you know, and I'm always like trying to get back to that person who like didn't give a fuck. So is there anything sort of different with advice to getting back to that kind of place?
It's what
in performance?
Well, it's what you're saying, the practice.
Okay.
You can want it all you want, you know. I think about the like the Brene Brown, the power of vulnerability, mm-hmm. and all this stuff. I say, oh, that's great to want and talk about and desire, but you've been so conditioned. They put you in a classroom, and if you got upset, they go, don't cause trouble. So you go, okay, so I have to be a better liar and cut myself off from my feelings and be a good little dutiful child, and that's what I get rewarded for. And so that gets over and over emphasized that you get rewarded for disconnecting and not being responsive. So you have to practice. It's just like you'd practice. It's not natural to do yoga. Mm-hmm. It's not natural to do aerobics. You just have to willfully practice working to be free.
Mm. And you get used to it. It's like anything. What's unnatural becomes natural.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the more you do it. And that's why when people are like, oh, I don't want to watch other people work. I'm like, but don't you understand? It's going to make you clear about what the work is contextually. It's going to make you feel better about yourself because everybody makes the same, you know.
Yeah, and you'll always learn something. I don't get why people are like that.
Well, people have, the world is so interesting. People are like, why can't I be in privates? And I'm like, because you wouldn't sing in a shower and really learn how your voice sounded. You don't want to be in isolation. You want to be in relation to other people. And God help you when you get on a set. I mean, I said I cried so easily in class. I was like hysterical all the time. And then all of a sudden I get in front of, you know, the Joy of Sex and it's like, okay, this scene, the teacher is bawling. And I'm like, you know, I'm on the set and I don't think that was a scene you were in. And I was like, Martha, you know, I can't, I'm not crying. And she goes, well, we can use the drops. I'm like, no, I don't want drops. I'm going to make myself cry. You know, and I'm like driving myself crazy and they only have so many takes. So, you know, I think that the more you do it, the more you assign less weirdness to it, and the more free you get, and the more you associate it with crying is a feeling that is as beautiful as joy.
Mm.
It's part of me.
Mm-hmm. What about when you guys coach people for auditions and then they get to the part? Do a lot of people freak out? Like, what am I going to do without you there? So then they likely have like on set coaching for like every scene. Like, how does that work?
It's not on set, and very few directors are happy with
in their trailer.
In their trailer, I've done that, and but mostly at the house or,
uh-huh.
or at the studio, we'll break down the script. Joanne does that extensively.
Yeah, let's get into some of the people that you guys coach, we're here to name drop.
Well, I mean, I don't really do anything anymore, so much teaching or coaching as I am out there in the rigorous, rejecting, humiliating life of auditioning, acting, writing my life story, you know, starting as a fledgling beginner, crawling through stand-up, just learned how to write one joke, and I've been doing it for 6 months. I just learned how to write one joke. But I do still coach some people. So I did just fly to New York, and I did just coach Halle Berry.
To name a few.
to the first movie she had to star in and direct at the same time. And as a matter of fact, I coached her, and I sat in a room with her for 12 hours, and I only went to the bathroom twice. And that was because she was so busy directing and had so many things to do in that position that she had not yet approached the part, and they were starting to shoot, and I had to go off the plane to her house, coach her through the whole script, work with her on it. But, you know, when I'm working with someone like Halle Berry, and there's very few people, Leslie Mann, whoever, people don't need me. To me, they don't need me. Like, they could teach me things as an actress. I wish they were coaching me. So I don't really think I add that much, but I think, I mean, they of course say that I am very helpful to them. I mean, I don't think they'd pay me if they thought it wasn't worth it. But I really feel there's a certain point that people get to and they're very used to what they're doing, and maybe they just want to do it in front of someone so that they're not shocked when they get on set.
Mm-hmm.
Or hear an idea collaborated with.
Yeah.
But I normally don't coach people like you normally don't. That would be like those people that I had been coaching for years prior. you know, Robin Wright, maybe. I was going to do something for Mariska. But contemporarily, I don't really do it too often. And people don't want to do it because I have a price that then when they hear at the school, they say, I don't want to do it with her. She's too much money.
For students or for?
For anybody.
Oh,
I
but
just
don't
try to make it unattractive.
Don't they just get the studio to pay for it? Or
well,
no?
That is not necessarily true.
Oh, really?
If only.
And that's a really good thing.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that is true, but that used to be true.
Okay.
It's a pet.
That's what I thought I had heard in the past.
Yes, that used to be true.
It's a pet peeve of mine that so little regard in the industry is given to that, whereas in athletics, you have a coach for just the receivers, just the offensive line. But somehow, you know, they don't rehearse in the business either.
But you coached a lot of people. You coached William Decoder for In the Bedroom, the brilliant Sundance movie, and then later directed Nick Stahl in your movie. And he never said to you that he felt anything other than, you coach me and then I've got it. He didn't want you to go to the set. He never wanted
further. No.
I don't know if anybody ever said to me,
I did it with
the
kids. I went to a set when they were kids.
That was for Martha.
Martha and for Judd.
Oh, for Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
You coach him?
No, I coached the kids that were in a movie that he was doing.
And you coached...
producing.
Keanu Reeves for Sam Raimi.
Mm-hmm.
But you never went to a set with these people.
Only the kids.
Only the kids.
You coached all those people ahead of time somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You break it down and
work out the choices.
I wouldn't want to go to a set because I selfishly want to act.
Yeah.
And I would feel that a director would look at me sideways and be like, who's this woman think she is? Although I will tell you, James Gandolfini, who is like one of my favorite actors of all times, may rest in peace, was a Meisner-trained Esper guy. And he had a woman in his trailer for every scene of the Sopranos.
Oh, wow.
For his whole life. She never wasn't there. She was there for every single scene.
He said, I never did a line that she didn't go over with me.
Wow. Yeah.
That's amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
So some people, I guess, really do that.
Yeah.
But I'd be scared that a director would be like, I'll never cast her. She got in the way of my interpretation.
Oh, so they get, like, insecure that, or not insecure, but just, like, annoyed that they're going to be getting in the way. Oh,
that's
okay.
Right. Yeah, like, one person's going to say one thing, the coach, and the director's going to say another thing, and the actor's going to get confused.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I get it. I really get it, you know?
Something you brought up when you were talking about Hallie, how she was so focused on directing, she hadn't spent time worrying about her performance, and, you know, you've probably acted in something you've directed before as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to like make that switch. And I'm wondering for myself because, you know, I like did like a little short and now I'm prepping to do another one. And both of them I directed and acted in. And the other one that I did, I just cut myself out of it because I did not spend enough time preparing. Mm-hmm. I literally did nothing. I was so focused on everyone else. I thought it would be fine, but I couldn't turn that switch off. And now in preparation for this next short that I'm going to be making, I'm like, damn, I really need to do something different. Like I might have to have half hour to decompress, or like, what do you suggest to people to like make that switch? I talked to David Wayne about this as well, actually. Do you know who he is? Yeah. The Wet Hot American Summer, Wanderlust, Children's Hospital, all those.
Was he in things that he... Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
so he wrote and directed all of those.
Of course.
He didn't write Children's Hospital, but he directed a bunch of them. He has a new show, Medical Police, out.
Mm.
But he's like super funny, works with all the best people. And he was like, yeah, it's really hard to, but I still didn't get like that piece of advice. So I was wondering.
Well, when you first said it, like your problem may have been watching yourself too. It may be if you were watching other actors, you wouldn't have been so critical of yourself in the editing room. It's possible that you, how do you feel about that? You think you could got past the fact that, oh, I don't like the way my ears are. Oh, that's curling in my lip or whatever.
Yeah, I was watching critically, I think, going through like the footage, but also just in general, like, just like realizing, oh, I'm directing everyone else, like, but there's no one for me. And then like just making that switch, I just felt like disconnected.
But when you watch yourself, you really felt you gave yourself a fair judgment of if.
Well, I hate watching myself.
That's what I'm saying. So yeah. As you watch it, maybe that could have contaminated.
Maybe you were too hard on yourself.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Maybe you were actually kind of wonderful, but you couldn't get over the fact that.
Did anybody else see it who also thought that was a problem? Because if they didn't, then that would be interesting. Because maybe you're just hating yourself and someone else looks at it and goes, no, you were really
good. You're not blinking too
much. But beside watching yourself, what about like just making that transition if you're directing something and then it's time for like your scene? Do you not think that there's any sort of...
Well, you don't get directed in show business like barely at all anyway. You just got to get self-sufficient.
Uh-huh. Well, here's what I would say, because I did go through this with Hallie, and I did study how do you do two things at once.
Yeah.
And I did see how crazily hard it is psychologically. What I said, ultimately, and I tried to come to, was number one, have more preparation on your part. Instead of less preparation, have more preparation. Make sure that you take care of yourself. Number two, find one person you trust. Could be the cinematographer, could be the AD, but somebody whose taste you trust that you think has a brain about art, and say to them, tell me if I need a second take, and have them on the set there. Three, if you really feel, and this happened with Jackson Pollock, I went to an audition for Jackson Pollock, which was Ed Harris's movie, and there was a woman sitting there, and I recognized she was an acting teacher. And it didn't occur to me until later, she was on everything that he did because he was playing Jason Pollock. And he was not wanting to watch himself. So he took his acting teacher, made her a producer, had her cast the movie with him, and then she sat there. But you could also have a cinematographer who's artistically evolved. But I say prepare really hard in your role. Have someone else watching you and take a moment in between each thing you're doing directing to say, everybody, I'll be in character. Don't say one word to me about anything else. I'll be back in a second. And make a psychological and physiological move back and forth. That's the only thing I could think of that I tried to do and suggest recently to help someone who is having exactly what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And then afterward, they'd be like, I don't know if I even did that well.
Yeah. I'm going to jump around all over the place. What did you guys think about the movies this year? What are some that you really liked?
Well, I'm just over the moon over the last movie I saw. I think it's the best movie since Gravity, 1917.
Oh, I know. I haven't seen that yet. Everyone's talking about how good it is.
I love Jojo Rabbit. I thought it was so funny and audacious and emotional and vulnerable and brilliant. And then I love Little Women and Marriage Story. But I have to say, I said to him, because I'm really not a director, and I don't want to be a director. And everybody's always like, but you're a famous teacher. And I'm like, that doesn't mean I want to be a director. I know the Meisner work. I don't want to direct. I've never wanted to. I'd like to act. I like to be with the family, like directed, not be the director. So I always have to say to him, can you explain to me about this movie, certain aspects that made it excellent? So I didn't understand what made 1917 brilliant until he explained it to me. Don't you see this? And then afterwards, like a person going to a museum who doesn't know what the paintings are except by the color. Oh, I like blue. I like, you know, oh, no. This is why this painting is extraordinary. He explained it to me. And now I realize maybe it's exactly, not maybe, I'm sure it's right. I defer to his expertise. That 1917 is a masterpiece, which is different than a beautifully done film or a gripping acting story, but a masterpiece in its totality. And that's what I can recognize that. But I'm emotional from, you know, Little Women, and I'm emotional.
I'm seeing that tonight.
Well, I thought Little Women was so fabulous and so beautiful, and I think you're going to really love it.
What about Parasite?
We liked it. It's a little on the bizarro side.
I loved it. It was my favorite.
Everyone loves it.
It was my favorite.
We like a movie called Shoplifters.
Yeah, I saw it.
We feel Shoplifters has some similar themes.
Totally.
And we thought it was more accessible in a connected kind of identifiable emotional relatedness. Parasite became more abstract and more extreme and more satirical. And people just flip for it, and it's going to win the Academy Awards. But I just didn't. Our student directed, he produced Judy. So Renee,
I loved it. I thought she was incredible. Yeah.
She was incredible.
And I was really
Mickey
blown away by
was
her.
An alumni and he produced it, so that makes me very excited.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah.
I'm very happy for him.
What I thought was interesting about Parasite is that there was like three different tone shifts.
There
which
was.
Is like really hard to accomplish, I think.
I thought it was wild and zany.
Yeah.
And for me, wild and zany may just be a little bit, you know, I love funny and I love odd, but I guess I think odd is, you know, Margot at the wedding. Where
or Jojo Rabbit is odd. That's very
odd.
Well,
Jojo Rabbit is odd, but I could, but I, and I did have a moment when it started. What is Hitler doing? But then I just got into it and I was like, oh my God, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
But people love Parasite. It's going to win. It's going to maybe win in several categories.
Definitely, 100%.
Yeah, everybody loves it. It's very, you won't hear people not like it. But I try not to voice unpopular opinions too much because I don't want to be a judge because I'm an actress. Mm-hmm. I'm like you. I feel vulnerable. I go up. I judge myself harshly. I, you know, have fear. I don't like to tell somebody. It's so hard to do anything. More props to you that you even tried.
Yeah.
That you even got up there and you made something. So I don't like to be too much of a judge because people like, you're a famous teacher. Your word is this or that. I don't like to go that far. So I just say, for me, this is what resonated. Mm-hmm. And I can identify acting and what is excellent about it. I could tell you that. But I try not to, like, come down like a hammer on people.
Damn, I need to be more like that.
Well, I came to that after I got unpopular reactions from people.
Oh, really?
I mean, I'm much older than you. I'm old enough to be either your mother or grandmother. And so,
not grandmother.
Okay, mom. And so it just feels like, you know, you learn things along the way. You make mistakes in life, and you mm-hmm. learn this isn't the right thing I did the right mm-hmm. way.
Yeah, what are some big lessons you guys have learned in being in this industry? Tips for other people.
Well, I'm very hard on myself and I'm, you know, nearly suicidal if I don't get a part. So I would advise people.
Does that still affect you?
Terribly. I have mixed up being accepted and loved with acting in a deeply disturbed way. And the therapy I've invested in, I mean, literally like 40 years of it, for my particular background, tragically, has not rooted that out. But anybody that is healthy enough to separate the craft of acting from the experience of being accepted and loved and can separate those two things and understand that it is a profession no different than other professions. You cannot take it personally. You do your best. Create things if people won't hire you. Don't make your life miserable because you feel you haven't been accepted in the in crowd. That can be done by a lot of people, even though they may struggle with the momentary disappointments. I think I'm an exceptionally take-it-hard person due to my, like, psychiatric troubles.
Yeah.
But it's not helpful. It's not helpful to get the next job done if you feel that bad. It's really better to be resilient and just brush yourself off and say, on to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, my advice to anybody is do everything you can to make yourself feel good. Throw out your sides after an audition, which I never listened to. Stop calling people and saying, did they call? You know, don't go to bed at night thinking about how you screwed it up. Really try just to improve your skill and like yourself.
Yeah, do you get in your car and you're just like...
No, I sometimes, when I see self-tapes, I'm like, I did it the best I could and it was excellent. And they still didn't take me. So for me, it's a head trip. Not if I just like, oh yeah, I see why they cast her. It's worse sometimes, but that tape was the best one and they said it was. Why didn't I get it? I can't quite figure out, you know.
It's impossible. You never will.
You never
figure
will.
It out. So it's
never.
Like, why even try?
Never. And I think.
And it's always going to go to their fucking friend. Sorry to curse, but right?
But rejection, and DW, you know, said this about the girl who invented Spanx, that the father. Tell that because that's a powerful thing.
Yes, tell us.
This is a gal who was selling faxes out of her trunk, she says. So she was not born to wealth, and she became wealthiest woman under 30 or, you know, at a certain age. She's a billionaire. And she said she owes it all to her dad, who celebrated rejection.
He celebrated
it?
Yeah.
Rejection.
So he would say,
that's
yeah.
I've never
yeah,
heard that.
Yeah. So he would, like, go, you're going to go audition for the musical. He goes, Dad, I can't sing. You're going in there. So she'd come out and go, Dad, it was terrible. And he'd high-five her.
Hmm.
She learned that every time she got a no on a printing machine or a fax machine, for whatever reason, it's just a successful endeavor. It's a positive. And she turned that in her head in a way that made her so damn resilient that when people said, you can't sell Spanx, are you psycho? She was like, you said no. On to the next.
Wow. Yeah.
And she became a billionaire because her thinking was not, stay in bed for a week. They didn't want me for NCSI. I'm going to kill myself. I could have been a Marine. And, you know, I could have shot a gun and I would have seen Mark Harmon and now I'm through.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thinking decimates you. And we come from fragile backgrounds, artists. We came into the imaginary world because maybe the real world was so painful. You're going to drag all that bad feeling in. It's not going to keep the playing field clear for your talent.
Mm-hmm.
So talent to me is not really just God gave it to you or the universe gave it to you. It's the tenaciousness to want something and the ability to pursue it without interfering with yourself. Like most things that take you down, mostly, aren't just the outside forces, it's the inside forces.
Mm-hmm. Getting in your own way.
Big time. And people don't realize that. They don't realize when they say, I didn't know anybody, I wasn't pretty enough. They don't know. You know what? There's a lot of people who had nothing. Oprah had nothing. She peed in an outhouse. You know, you can tell those stories. Why did those people get so tenacious? Somehow they carved through the impossibility. So everybody's got their corner of impossibility.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most untalented people in my mind, which was why I never tell anybody not to act, that really had trouble acting, I said, you know, you're so robotic and you're mechanical. Why don't you try writing? And the girl said to me, no, I'm going to be successful. And I was like, oh, this girl's delusional. Such trouble ahead. Oh,
such trouble ahead.
This girl's life is doomed. And then she was like, but I really appreciate you offering your opinion, and I really value it. And I was like, oh, my gosh.
She had such good parents, you know, like to be like.
She had such self-love.
Wow.
And now she's working constantly, sending little posts out. My next job, working actress, loving my life.
Wow.
On set. And I wrote her a note and I said, you know what? The ability to tell yourself, I will do what I want to do, that may be like even the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Nobody can reject you if you don't reject yourself.
Mm.
You can always write something, direct something, shoot something, pick up your phone. You know, a lot of people, I don't want to do that because until somebody important discovers me, discover yourself.
Totally. Yeah. Be proactive. That's what, like, I feel bad for a lot of people who are strictly actors. They're just waiting for their next job instead of creating something, creating their own opportunities.
Absolutely.
Just in terms of brass tacks, what I'll recommend is, you know, there's a good advice. If you feel scared and you tell yourself, don't get scared, it's probably not going to work. Calm down. But if you tell yourself, I'm scared, you're scared, you tell yourself, this is exciting. You have a better
chance
to just like lean it over into something. And so I started saying this, you're going to be frightened of people watching you, but make it like an athlete. I'm less frightened of the people watching me than I am the characters I'm acting with. So this guy playing my dad is, I'm going to have to deal with him. That's what I should be really scared of, is these fictional realities, and that can immerse you then into that. Yeah, I know that people are watching me. Yeah. But what I'm really concerned about is that this life of my character have impact the objectives I'm going for in the imaginary world. And there's a, you know, very strong magical thing about the imaginary world, whether it's you know, channeling your muse or whatever, something actually mystical, or just something about our makeup. That playing pretend is very powerful. So if you can find a way to seduce yourself that way by going, that's what's important, is what's going on in the imaginary world, not these casting directors over here. Because they don't, you know, the advice I give people is that they, and I just heard Leonardo DiCaprio being interviewed talk about this when he was young and how he got successful, is he said he failed at an audition and then he kind of gave up and realized they don't want you to, they don't want to have to validate you. So I tell you guys, when you come go into audition, is you want to audition the way a doctor comes in to audition for giving you a surgery. You don't want to feel that, please let me do it. You go, I'm going to be a doctor whether you use me or not. I think I can do a great job, but I'm not dependent upon your love for my doctoring.
Yeah. So just not having that like desperate energy. Yeah, what are some tips for you, for actors who are listening, you know, if they have an audition, being comfortable in the room, stuff like that.
Just there's this paradoxical thing. If you don't want it so much, it's like, you know,
like, hey, what's up?
Yeah. Just find a way to go. I'm not, you know, there are all kinds of games people, like, they'll say, like, oh, there's no way I'm going to get this part. So I just know, there's no way I'm going
to. I had a desire to have a TV pilot, and I didn't know enough to know that this would be like a million and a gazillion chance. The innocence of when you begin something, you have no idea. And I said, I'm here for a week from New York, and Lovers and Other Strangers is auditioning, and Bill Esper had the scene in class between Jerry and the character, and I'm going to get an audition. And I don't know how I got an audition. I still don't really know how I got an audition. But I got an audition, and I went to the audition, and I remember saying out loud in the lobby, I can't get this, because Miss America, the woman married to the guy from Kiss, she was against me. All of the women that look like you, gorgeous, they were all against me. And I was like, I have a funny face. This isn't going to work out, but I'm going to have fun. And I kept telling myself, I won't get it, I won't get it, I won't get it. And I went on 10 auditions like that. And when I finished the last one, the woman who wrote it, Renee Taylor and Joe Bologna, stood up in the audition at ABC with 30 people, said, you're getting this part.
Oh, my God.
Then I took my car and drove it into a tree. So that explains that I still didn't have self-worth.
Wait, but right before, when you're in the room before going in, you're saying, right. I'm not going to get it. But isn't that like, wouldn't that set you up to feel small?
You know what? I say, do what works for you.
Okay.
I don't feel like I'm entitled to be successful. I have like a particular psychic background,
right,
with, you know, violence and, uh-huh, crazy parenting and with sibling, you know, competition.
Yeah.
So I have to tell myself, don't worry, you're not going to be successful. It'll all work out. And then I have to go in with none of that fear that it will go that way. Somebody else I've heard say 100 times, I go in and say, I'm going to get it. No one else can have it. And that works for them.
Yeah.
I say, work with your own mentals.
That makes sense.
We're talking about Renee Zellweger. She says, yeah, she never would have gotten Jerry Maguire if she'd thought there was a chance she was going to get it.
Oh, I heard her on a podcast talking about it. And I loved her so much more when I heard her talking about it. She said she couldn't believe she got this audition at this whatever studio it was at.
That's Julia Roberts.
And that she was riding in a convertible with the windows down, laughing the entire way there in like the best of spirits, and just like, this is like ridiculous. I'm going to meet Tom Cruise. Like, okay. And she was like, the wind was blowing my hair like all over the place, and I was just laughing my way into the office because I was like, this is, but she had that like small town, adorable tech, like, you know, like, oh, this isn't like, I wish I had that.
And look what happened to her. This is a good life lesson. She went through something where she was not accepted for a period of time. She got out of favor. People judged her.
Yeah.
She felt terribly
the past
rejected.
7 years or
and
is
she,
it?
Yep. And she felt very humiliated. And even now when she won the Golden Globe, she openly said, I have been more or less rejected for a long time. And my representative said to me, screw it, Renee, just do your work.
Mm.
So she went through a head trip. Just like everybody in life has, you know, it, like marriage, like anything, like raising a kid, your health, life, family, you're going to go through ups and downs. And the key is to find who you are in it and speak to yourself in ways that is full of love and helps you, you know, rise. And that's knowing who you are. So for me, it might be you're not going to get it, takes the pressure off. And for someone else, that would be self-defeating. But you just sort of have to lock into who you are and what your vulnerabilities are.
Mm-hmm. DW?
Yeah, that's what I say, you know.
Anything else?
Just be good. Be really good. Practice enough, and then you go, I'm in it for the acting. And again, I don't need these people to validate me. I'm going to, yeah, like, willing to suffer or do whatever.
$5 to people to let me try to practice comedy. If you told me at this age, middle-aged woman, going to places and saying, can I give you $5 because I need to practice?
Uh-huh.
I mean, the mentality of that may not apply in everything in my life, but it should. You should always say, I love what I'm doing and I'm doing it to do it.
Has it been humbling for you?
Humbling. Humbling. Humbling.
I know.
Humbling. Oh, my God. Humbling. And when I sit down and they go, you know, you're a funny person, but you don't have an act.
Uh-huh.
And I say, what's an act?
Oh, because you were probably just going up and talking, right? And like telling funny stories.
I thought I was doing something.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, you need to tell a joke. You know, this is joke oriented.
A guy told her, you can't be shielding your eyes from the lights.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think you had something going, but I couldn't see you because you were covering your eyes.
I know, they're very bright on stage.
And then another guy said, did you hear anyone laugh? Because you were talking over when they laughed, and that's not good.
Uh-huh.
If they do laugh, be happy and be quiet for a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, almost everything backwards. Almost everything. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I really love learning. I've always wanted to be a student. I like to be in an acting class. I like to learn things. I like to be directed. So it's humbling in exactly the way that I kind of like it. But it is, it's humbling, but I don't have a prideful attitude. So it does. I'm weird that way. I've never been like, you embarrass me. I'm more like, okay, so I don't know what I'm doing. I'll learn.
And you tried stand up too?
Oh, years and years ago. This thing.
And not recently?
No, recently in New York, she went to one of these things and, what was it, New Year's Day or something like that? So they were like very loose, these guys. And then, and
sometimes
so I went and told the story.
How was it? Were you nervous?
No, because I tell stories in class.
Yeah, that's true.
It wasn't really that funny. It was extremely entertaining and full of self-confidence and grace and poise because he's a brilliant speaker. So, of course, it was entertaining, but he didn't, like, have a punchline or anything.
Right. You were just talking.
Like a monologist,
where's this
going? Know, yeah.
But I did meet a girl who is an intern, does something on some comedy show, and I said to her, could you write a joke for me?
Yeah.
So that was the thing.
Uh-huh.
She wrote me a joke. So then
how was it?
Well, I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
So it was one joke or two jokes, and then I said, okay, I'll pay you for a joke. And then somebody sent me a note saying how to write jokes, a book. But I love learning. I like learning things. I would love to learn more. I wish I could go back to college, and I'd like to be in an acting class. I really love to be with people and learn.
Yeah.
I like that. I've always liked that. That's my happiest thing, is being in a group, being part of a family, being directed. I like that.
Mm.
You know? I wouldn't have been a teacher if I had had the level of success that, you know, Bill Esper had aimed for.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have taught. But there's, you know, a plan in the universe, and the school has people that are gifted and beautiful like you that have come out of it. So it's really been a blessing in the world.
Why were you guys drawn to the Meisner technique out of the other techniques?
I was, maybe I didn't say, because you just fell into it, a guy told me, but I was a Strasberg person.
Uh-huh.
I got involved with Lee Strasberg work at a very early age, ridiculously early age. And worked with Lee Strasberg. I was all into that. And then I heard the Meisner thing. Usually, I don't know if you heard it mocked, because there's a technique in the very beginning of repetition where you repeat the last thing that the person said to you. So they say,
I like your shirt.
And then I go, you like my shirt. I don't go, you like my shirt. I really respond to it. So I'm confirming that you just said that. You like my shirt. And I'm pleased by that. Or you like my shirt. That's an odd thing to say. But I don't have to make up dialogue. So I'm just confirming. And so I'd heard that about that technique, and it usually was mocked. You know that acting technique where you repeat? Because it is mockable if you're just going to go, you like my shirt, mimicry. But then I met Joanne. It's a really funny story. I don't know if I ever told this in class. I went on a date with her, and then she came to a play. So I went on a regular date with her, and then I was doing this play, and I had her come to the play. And I guess she maybe said she was an acting teacher, but wasn't in my mind, because we go, so come to the play and afterwards we'll go out. So after the play, I go, so we're going to get something to eat. And she brings out her program. She's got all these notes on it. Well, we need to talk about that monologue that you've been doing. And so then I got like, what are you thinking doing? You're critiquing my performance? There's certain, you're good, but there's certain issues. And so she went through this thing with me. So I got introduced to the Meisner technique through her, and then became a real convert. Because it's so much cleaner psychologically, or, you know, you don't have to leave your care.
Can you briefly summarize the different techniques for listeners who don't know?
So I'll just say, I went to Herbert Berghoff, I went to Lee Strasberg, I went to all these different places, and there's a lot of different techniques, and you know a lot of them, but the Strasberg technique is more experientially, personally, remembering trauma, not imagining things that are fantasy. It's, you know, call me by my character's name. It's work that is exercise-y and sometimes self-conscious and isn't a comprehensive approach that gives you a beginning, middle, and end to a script, which is why I think Meisner turns people out who are directors and editors and costumers and production designers also, because every aspect of acting is covered in it. Stephen Adley Gergis, the greatest playwright, said that he never went to writing class. He just took Bel Esper's class. Strasberg is really the big counterpart to Meisner. Meisner is imagination, and it's script interpretation and character analysis, and is very complementary with Stella Adler, which is how to break scripts down and how to plan behavior and preset emotions to create interpretive performances, similar to a choreographer planning dance steps and then improvising it after. The other kinds of techniques, you know, Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, the Australian school.
External.
They're more external, but hey, what can I tell you? Australian actors and English actors are pretty damn brilliant, because their physical and their vocal expressiveness is very articulate, and it really does raise the game of a lot of acting when you have people who are able to really understand that the actor is an instrument, his voice and his body, not just his imagination and his emotions.
Oh, so is that what the difference is between, okay.
I think the difference is that D.W. is saying that the, you know, Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, English actors and Australian actors, I forget the name of that school.
RADA?
It's external. But I'm not so sure it's external when I look at, you know, people like Nicole Kidman, who really are emotionalizing.
Or this 1917.
Or 1917.
I'm thinking about Succession. A couple of people on Succession.
I don't know that that well. But
like, you never saw it?
You're talking about the dad who's the...
Well, Brian Cox.
Brian Cox.
But yeah, I was also thinking about the woman who plays Shiv.
Oh.
And the guy who plays Tom, but I don't know what their names are. But they're very good.
One of them just won the Critics of Choice.
He played the Mr. Darcy.
Yeah. I think that when I see people like that, it's hard for me to say that it's just, quote, external. But what I do recognize is that the craft of acting, with speech, with voice, with physical life, is so much the whole instrument, and that American actors are really more about my feelings, my emotions, mm-hmm. and a casualness in vocality, and a casualness in the physical life. And I think you have to give a lot of attention to physical relaxation, because emotions bring tension. You have to give a lot of attention to the speech and the voice, because if your voice is all when you get acted, and it's strained, or it's high-pitched, or it's not breathed, all those things really contribute. So the
breathing and posture, stuff like that.
It's very important, and it really creates a whole instrument. Like, you're a flute, you're a violin, you know, you're a piano, you're not just one part. So I do feel like, you know, my favorite actor now is Matthias Schoenhardt. You know, he's Belgian. He did Rust and Bone. He did
Mustang was the most recent.
Is the most recent. But what's the name of the movie that is the classic that he did?
Far From the Madding Crowd.
Far From the Madding Crowd. He's one of the great. I told him when I met him, you know, you're like the Brando. You're like the Belgian Brando. He liked that. But he really is quite brilliant. And I think he's got an amalgam of kind of like an American and English. He's got like method. And method is mistaken for Strasberg, but it's really Meisner. It's anything that's updated Stanislavski. It's method if it's you living with your imagination and your emotions. But if you could live with your imagination and your emotions in a healthy way, which I think is Meisner, not Strasberg, and in a powerful way that didn't interfere with your voice and your physical life, I think the whole instrument sings. Like Kathy Bates, who's up for the Academy Award now, and Sam Rockwell, and Allison Janney, all these people are, you know, out of the Meisner. And I think that they show a lot of what that can be in developing characters and a variety of characters. And being alive and being imaginative.
Yeah. What for being alive and imaginative, what are some things you can do to be more of that?
Train.
Struggling with the questions here.
You can train, get, you know, more familiar with, like, playing tennis. Get more familiar with being raw and being in the environment where you can freely just throw it out there.
Mm-hmm.
If I was to address the three kind of techniques, we're saying the external, a purely external actor isn't really doing anything except for trying to get the audience to believe that it looks like that. So if I'm mad at you, how dare you talk to me that way? But you know, I'm not really mad. And I'm not really addressing this to you. That's a purely external. And then you have the Strasberg type actor who is connected to their feelings. How dare you talk to me like that? So he's upset, but he's not really talking to her.
right. It's like all about them.
Yeah. So they have genuine feeling. And film may favor that because then they'll cut to you biting your lip and they'll believe, oh, there's this emotional
connection. So was that Kristen Stewart? That's who I like automatically just thought of.
That's right, yeah.
Just always like...
yeah, so she's got this feeling, but it isn't being directed. And okay. That what we go for and would even say maybe somebody who's trained externally bridges this by going, yeah, but I'm really trying to get an objective. So I'm really in this moment connecting you, this person you are, and I'm trying to get you. It's not okay for you to do this. How dare you talk to me that way? And I'm now like really in the moment with you.
I got scared.
I'm really in the moment trying to live this in the total now. And only you can give me the fear in your eyes or the thing that I need in the moment that I'm going to be reassured that I'm getting closer to my objective.
Mm.
So if you're an external, you may be trained external and then learn this technique a lot. Most of good acting does come together and in the same place, especially certainly film acting. Not on stage. We still see stage performances that are extremely external, where you go, he's not really going through any experience at all. But in film,
But a great actor like Brando could be on stage and do the same performance and then do it in a film, and it was the same specificity and articulation. So a really great actor should be able, you know, a masterful, skilled person should be able to do the same behavior, the same specific actions, the same inner life, emotional preset preparations, and really create the same performance. And you could say, oh, he's too big or he's too small, and you can adjust it, but it should be the same dance that they're doing interpretively. Imagination, to me, the definition of talent is the degree that an actor comes in contact with his imagination. But I can tell you that there's people that have gone to this school that I did not think were that highly imaginative. And they had exercises and things that they did to lure their imaginations and to seduce themselves into deeper degrees of contact with fantasy. And so I'm one of those weird people that has a pretty, you know, high-profile school in the world that doesn't say you're talented, you're not. I say, look, this information, only you and God knows how far you can go with it. And even after you finish, you may go further than I ever remember what you were. Don't let anybody tell you you're good or bad, and don't let anybody audition you and tell you you're accepted or rejected. Just jump into it and give it your all, and you don't know what you're capable of. Your teacher doesn't know what you're capable of, and actually no one knows what you're capable of, because there are many experiences where you think you've written someone off, and you're mm-hmm. like, oh, they can't act. And they shock you and they shock themselves.
Did you have that in class? Anybody you went the first like few months you thought like, oh, this guy, she's never gonna. And then later you go, wow, in that scene.
I definitely saw people grow a lot.
Because we've seen miraculous things.
Really?
Yeah. Sometimes we've seen people you like would really go, this is just not for them.
Yeah.
And even after they finish the training, you'll see them and you go, something happened. The gears meshed.
Yeah.
And so that's just exciting. You never know when the fruit could show up.
Yeah. I can't remember as far back as first year, to be honest, with stuff like that. But I would just notice a lot of people have got a lot better and like notice as a whole, like the entire class really like progressively, you know.
More substantive, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I definitely have my favorites and I would get so excited to watch certain scenes, like the scene with Sarah and Dominic. Icky. I was so excited to watch that scene every time. What about, so I have a couple of questions from the WhatsApp group from the class. I told them I was having you on. Yeah. But I also talk about like when you're acting drunk. How to act drunk. Maybe can you give a little drunk lesson? We can close with that.
Okay. The thing that people say most
Wait. Let me do the questions and then we'll end with the fun thing.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm directing you. Let's see. I was going to organize this, but I'm sorry. Okay. Some of these aren't great.
Come on, be professional.
Okay. it's okay. Now I can't say that one actually. Fuck, I fucked it up. Well, what advice do you guys give couples trying to achieve balance with work and relationship?
Marriage counseling.
For every, any conflict with him. Yeah.
This is a good one. What irritates you guys the most in each other? Three things or personality traits?
Three of them? That's a lot.
I know. That's what the...
Him giving you marriage advice.
Really?
You shouldn't be doing anything like that.
It wasn't a weird moment. It was meant to be positive.
But he's not supposed to talk personally to anybody.
No, that was just general. It wasn't personal.
He's never supposed to talk personally to anybody.
I give my general...
In the Me Too generation.
It was like a general, like on a Monday sort of thing where he covers everything.
Yeah.
I'm just worried now that we can't even say he, she, they, or it. And I don't know what the hell it is.
Did you notice I start my podcast by saying, hey, guys? And I do it every time and I'm used to it. And I know that some people, you shouldn't say, hey, guys. You just say, hey, everybody.
But to be honest,
I'm fucking saying, hey, guys. Like, sorry. That's how I like to start my podcast.
The thing that irritates me the most about my husband, he's worked on in marriage counseling. So I would say that it's hard to say what irritates me because we have been devoted to staying married and we have worked very hard at staying married by working on ourselves.
Yes.
So I really feel like it's hard to say what irritates me because every single topic that's a problem, we have worked on with diligence. And I think the greatest thing you can have is somebody who irritates you in 3 to 50 things, but the one thing that they don't irritate you on is they're in it to win it with you.
Mm.
They're going to stick in it with you. You're going to tell them what upsets you. They're going to care, and they're going to keep going.
Yeah. We're in couples therapy, too.
I love it.
Already.
And that's going to make
But we like it. We really want to grow together and learn how to communicate better. And we get mad at, he sees me as his mom. I see him as my dad.
Normal.
So, like, it's like historical, hysterical stuff. Yeah. Like, is this really about, like, you not helping me with cleaning or am I your mom?
Yeah.
And it's stop blaming me for, like, what she did to you.
And the fact that you both enjoy working on it means that your marriage is important and important enough to make the issue less important than the marriage staying important.
Mm.
That's it. When people say, what's your secret? You've been married 34 years, 35 years.
34.
I say, there is no secret. I could have been divorced just like you. The secret is I decided not to leave.
Yeah.
That's my secret. I decided to stay. How's that for a big secret?
I think a lot of people, especially with dating, I always see people are always trying to find something wrong with the other person. And it's like...
Or they find one thing and they go, that's the thing I was waiting to see. Now I have a reason
looking for something specifically. Yeah. Here's another one. Method versus Meisner. Do best actors use use both techniques?
Method is known to be Strasberg in a confusion in the world. All methods that use imagination and personal emotion are method.
Stanislavski.
They're Stanislavski. So really, Meisner and Strasberg and Stella... All those three, they're all method acting. But if you say Strasberg or Meisner, which is what that question really means to be saying, you can answer that.
I just kind of did.
Yeah, I feel like these are a little bit of a revisit. Yeah, and this one was what you were briefly talking about. If you play the same character on stage and in a movie, what adjustments do you do to your acting, things you pay more attention to?
I wouldn't do anything different if I was Marlon Brando doing Upwards Descending and then I did it on a movie, except for if they said smaller or bigger. I mean, it's the same character.
Volume.
That's not a big adjustment.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
So if you do a play, you have to do an English accent. Or a movie, you'd have to do an English accent. You do a theater, and so you're not mic'd. You got to just be a loud person instead of using the British accent.
But still the same articulation in your accent. Yeah. Still the same behavior. You know, still the same emotional point of view. I think you'd have a big problem if you start changing interpretation. I don't think people know what acting is.
Uh-huh.
They don't know what it is to break down behavior. It is reacting, but then it's planning the interpretation like a choreographed dance step before you react. So it's really like, okay, what step and what emotion before the step, and now I improvise it off the other person. So it gets back to reacting after you preset and interpretively plan what the geography, emotionally and behaviorally, is of the character.
What about when you do all this work, like what you were just saying, and then you get there and they had a different plan? You know, you have to adjust the person.
Well, that can happen, and people say that's the best skill that a film actor can have, because on the day, all kinds of things. They don't rehearse. So maybe the actor you thought was going to be doing one thing is doing something completely, whoa, and the director's not going to adjust that. So that makes it really hard for me. So you have to be an adaptable pussycat.
I was on a TV show, Rake, for Sam Raimi, the great Sam Raimi, and I had auditioned crying my eyes out because I was like able to cry, good for me, that day. And I got the part of some victim, wife, whatever. It's a pilot with the actor, Greg, what's his
Kinnear.
Name? Greg Kinnear. And I'm like, get to the set. And Sam Raimi says to me, Joanne, we're making her a raving bitch. She has no feelings. She's just going to be very hostile. And she's not going to have any vulnerability at all.
That sounds fun.
And I was like, but didn't I get the part because I was like different than that? He goes, I know. We're going a different way.
That's like the complete opposite. But at least they trusted you enough to know you would make the adjustment.
Well, I don't think it worked out in the end. And then another time I did Webster. 100 years ago, there was a show called Webster. And I was supposed to play a Nazi. And when I got there, they said, play it like a Girl Scout.
What?
Swear.
I can't even wrap my head around that.
But I did it. I was able to do it. But the thing is, taking direction is like huge.
Yeah, let's talk about listening, taking direction, and then being open to notes and stuff. Like, what is your advice for people on that?
Well, I know my pet thing that I want to get out there in the world of actors is of all the problems you can have getting directed, probably the one that's going to be the biggest. Is that you think they're talking about your interior life and they're talking about what they want your character to be presenting to the world, or vice versa. So they say, hate her. It's like she's a monster. Then I come in, I go, sit down. And they go, you can't act like that. You're a lawyer. you just told me to be raging like that, but they won't know how to tell you. Yeah, feel raging, but then on the outside be presenting a professional behavior. Or the other way around, they'll go, all right, you're professional. You've done this 1,000 times. Then you go in and go, sit down. And they're like, it's not working. Why is it not working? They can't tell you, because he should be rageful underneath there or wounded underneath there as he's trying to be professional. So he's
talking about translating. There's two parts, I think, in taking direction. I think one part is take your parents out of it if they were hostile and critical. Because sometimes very talented people have had such abusive teaching from their original parents before teaching in school, that when they're told to do something, it's almost dangerous. So the person goes, go to the right, and you see the actor going to the left, and you're like, why are you doing the opposite? Well, some internal self-protective mechanism is like, you know, if I do what this person says, so first, take anybody out of it that's interfering in a historical way with your present ability to trust who's there. The second thing is, try to translate, like he's saying, what they're saying. It's not easy to translate it. I've made a million mistakes when I've been given a critique, thinking they were saying this, driving home saying, that's not what they were saying.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's like, are you even comfortable like talking back to the director, or are you just going to try the opposite?
Yes.
And know, okay, they must mean this.
Yes, that's a good point. How much do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, because they don't have time for that, right? They just want you to come in and do your job, and you should know and understand.
That's right. You got to consider yourself like the electrician. Nobody wants to talk to you about what you're doing. Do this thing, magical thing that you do. Don't burn
the
place down.
But the people that have the pride, the self-esteem, they aren't as frightened to alienate, and they're not trying to ingratiate. They really are just in that Buddhist middle zone, and they're able to stand there and say, I want to just ask you so I'm sure I understand what you're asking. They'll do that. I was always afraid to say, can I take another take? They'll think I'm awful.
Yeah.
And then a casting director said to me, no, you can do it with
time. In an audition, you're saying.
In an audition.
Okay.
They say, like, do it again. Let's do that again. And I was like, I can say that? Like, you get confused between groveling and arrogance, alienating the person.
Yeah, maybe it's the energy that you have underneath.
Very much so. I think there are people, and I always envy them. I remember there was one girl, her name was Kelly Dunn. Kelly Dunn, if you ever hear this podcast, come and call me. She had like 13 people in her family. She was Irish Catholic. She seemed sane. We used to say in class, I love my family. I love my life. I was like, oh my God, this girl's disturbed. Everyone hated her. They were like, oh, Kelly, you're such a raving bitch, you know, telling people that. She was a happy person, and she was a brilliant actress, and we couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, and what was it?
She was really happy.
Her mom gave love to every 13, or she was the...
Somebody in that family.
Someone's fucked. Something. Of course, obviously.
But she was able to have that unusual background where she could handle things because she had an orientation in the world that worked. Mm. Like, having your head on straight is more than your talent, because it can make whatever talent you have rise. Having your head on backwards, that's a problem, because you could be brilliantly talented, and we've seen that. And then the person kind of sabotages themselves. It's really a lot of mind clarity.
Totally. Yeah, self-sabotaging.
Yes.
Huge.
Huge. Huge.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, the broadcast news, Albert Brooks' character goes, wouldn't it be great if desperation made us more attractive?
Yes! Okay, so should we get into the drunk tips? Anything else that you wanted to touch on before?
Well, I'll say this. I'm not advertising, but if somebody's interested, Baron Brown Studio is the name of the school.
Yeah, and do you want to just... Okay, it's a two-year program, little touch on that.
There's a six-week intensive. You can have an introduction. There's a class that starts in the fall that's two times a week. 6 weeks is three times a week. There's character interpretation and script analysis. That's like scene study. There's audition class. There's a master class that I have in February that's just monologues. And... you know, there's a variety of things to explore at the school, and you just call up the school and you meet with them. You don't audition. We don't believe in judging people's talents before they've been given the skill or this particular skill and from our school. And they interview, and you kind of just get a sense of them, and we get a sense of you, and we see what is appropriate.
And I can't recommend the training enough. It completely changed my life. I'm sure everyone comes out saying mm-hmm. that. It changed me on stage so much. I got so much better. And I just stopped thinking about myself and was able to just connect with the audience. And I just like, I don't get in my, you know, sometimes you get in your head and I just like, I pretty much just like, yeah, that all just went away. And it, you know, and just with listening so much more and, you know,
I love that.
Empathy. I mean, I feel like a sociopath saying I learned empathy, but like I did in a different, you understand.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
Totally.
There's this guy who's a genius, a futurist. His name is Harari. Wrote a book called Sapiens, and I heard him talking, and he was saying everybody in the future is going to have to stay in school because the future is developing so fast that you can't learn a trade and then just expect to practice it. So you have to constantly be in school, and because the best skill you could have is emotional intelligence. And he said, and I don't know how to tell you how to get it. And I wanted to yell out, go to Baron Brown, because anytime you put in there, like you say, it's just like a kind of athletic training, a flexibility training, a taking that veneer off you.
And you can do it again. There are people that, you know, have taken the first year or the second year, you know, more than once or twice. Mm. I personally would love to take the training again. Mm-hmm. I think it would improve me ridiculously as an actress and as a person. So I just think it's an extraordinary, helpful thing in life and in art.
Yeah.
Drunk tips?
Take it away.
Drunk tips?
Yeah. Because you're the pro.
Am I?
You're the pro on acting drunk.
I have a YouTube video on it.
What's the name so people could look it up on YouTube?
Playing Drunk, I think.
Oh, Playing Drunk, D.W. Brown?
D.W. Brown.
Great.
And how to get high on marijuana and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. That was like the fun part, learning impediments in class.
So the old-timer tip for playing drunk, which everybody will say, is try to act not drunk. Mm. So it's a basic thing that actually goes through a lot of what you do as an actor. You're trying to what Meryl Streep would say is you have to cry, try to not cry because that character doesn't want to cry. You have to laugh in a scene, try to not laugh. That there's that in thing, and so that's a reality. Not to act your limp, but try to act somebody who's not limping, not feeling that pain. So the same thing in being drunk is you try to act not drunk. So usually you're over enunciating. Trying to be clear with your speech because your tongue has been like shot with Novocaine. But the real cool tip that you can get from, I got it from Joanne, we got it from Bill, got it from Meister, I guess, is the emotional line, right? That came from Meister, Sandy, is, and a lot of people miss out on that, most people, vast majority of people, don't get that, is to when you play drunk, you want to get a consistent emotional line. So you are – typically it's an aloof drunk and consistent with not being drunk is I want to act like everything's great and I'm sophisticated. And they'll say, you know you're drunk when you feel sophisticated, but you can't pronounce it. So that's the typical kind of drunk that somebody who's aloof and like royalty and even a Skid Row person, little girl, they're nodding out, but they're acting like they're royalty. And then the other kind of drunks you got, you have a celebratory drunk. So those drunks aren't as concerned with not being seen drunk, but everything's a party. And even if they bang their head, oh my God, that hurt like hell. So when you have the emotional ongoing, every event elicits that response. So you have a celebratory drunk, you have a angry drunk, malevolent, like you're in a bad mood. I should have danced to your tune. And everything's foul. There's a particular kind I didn't put in my video that is a particular kind of angry drunk, which is really interesting, which is they would never think of themselves as angry. And this is somebody that I know would do this. And they're like this. Hey, Chelsea. No, Chelsea. Now, listen. I'm talking to you now. I really, really like you. I'm serious. And it's a kind of like...
Is that called the annoying drunk?
It's annoying. But I would put them in the category of an angry drunk. But they don't think they're angry. But they're like...
Controlling.
I saw this guy give money to a waiter. There. There's your money. And it was like, you pig. That's all you're about is your money. And it was like he like a wildly over-generous tip, but it was so foul the way he did it. There's your money. Hey, you did a good job. Why? And then the last one's the maudlin drunk. With somebody who's over-sentimental. And it could be something real. I'm never going to see her again. Or just anything. Oh, these bottles. Stupid. So that's the main thing is try to not be drunk and to hook into emotional line. And then when you play that emotional line, to stay with it, and you can do a transformation from a celebratory drunk into a maudlin drunk. Either because something happens, you see a photograph of...
Yeah, that's like every girl when she's drunk, right? Everything's fun, and then all of a sudden, I don't know what happened, but one thing will just be like, yeah.
When I taught this in
when
class...
When you don't get the text back.
I taught this in class one time, and somebody said, oh, that's so interesting. I had a roommate in college who would cycle through every one of those.
Yeah.
And we're all like, yeah, she's happy now. We got about, 15 minutes.
Totally. Yeah, I remember when I did drunk in class, it was so weird. When I walked through the door, I don't know how this happened because I wasn't planning on it. I didn't think about it. I just lost complete control, like in my muscles almost, or I don't know. And I fell to the ground. I don't know like how, but I just like went like limp like that. And then I had skinned both my knees and they were bleeding.
Oh.
And I was like, I really felt like I was drunk. And then like you feel like you're drunk like after when you're like coming out of it, right? It's so weird. And like the Coke, like, yeah, I love all that. It's so fun.
Well, you know that in real life that people are getting, they get high, they get, before they even stick the needle in their vein, they can see their, what the oxytocin or whatever that thing is going up in their system because it's cognitive psychology that when you do these behaviors, you actually will, like the placebo effect.
Yeah.
You think there's a painkiller and you're actually, your body produces that. That's the real magic of acting, right? Children can do it. And like, so if you really believe, you really jump in to play, pretend, your body starts going, oh, this really is your reality.
I love that. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on. This was so much fun. Check out, again, the Bear Brown Studio. Do you guys allow audits too?
We have a way of doing that.
Okay, cool. But yeah, check them out. Very talented actors and coaches. And we forgot to say DW was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
I was indeed.
Because I just I love that movie. I had the DVD growing up. In high school.
I do a real quick story on that.
Yes, we didn't even get into it.
I have a story about the movie, but
She's gonna be somebody's bitch. Isn't that the song?
Yeah,
I remember.
When I pick her up in the car. we have a yearly celebration at the school and get Jaimin Hunsu came this year and De Niro came one year.
Ooh.
And he had just done Raging Bull or something like really big like that. And a guy comes up like dead serious and shakes my hand and goes, I just shook hands with Robert De Niro. But he wasn't in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
I love it. Yes. I know. Was that fun working on it?
Oh, yeah.
Was it just one day? Or?
Oh, no, because I was at the mall, and then I did the thing.
Oh,
the,
you met her at the pizza counter.
Yeah,
I can't remember. Right. And then
yeah,
you, yeah. And then
the
you
Galleria.
Picked, oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Where was that?
That's the Galleria, the Ventura and 405.
Oh, okay. I know. I haven't seen that movie in so long, but I just remember the dugout scene.
Ha! Yes. Oh, that's why we never go backstage whenever we see a play with Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Oh, do you guys like ever drive by like dugouts? And she's like, "Come on, let's go."
That's so cute.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
Okay.
True role playing. Yeah.
Yes. I know. How is it for acting teachers with role play? Okay. Thank you guys so much for listening. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye. Thank you, Chelsea. Thank you.